French hornist Barry Tuckwell has been described as the finest French horn player of his generation and one of the finest horn players who have ever lived. That praise came from Winthrop Sargent in a 1977 New Yorker profile of Tuckwell. Barry Tuckwell was the first modern French hornist to have a sustained career as a soloist. The Australian-born musician played in the London Symphony Orchestra for 13 years before embarking on a solo career in 1966. Now he has a dual career as soloist and conductor. Since 1982, he's been the founding music director of the Maryland Symphony Orchestra. His guest conducting has taken him through Europe and the United States. His latest record features him conducting the London Symphony Orchestra in performances of Wagner overtures. Barry Tuckwell, welcome to Fresh Air. You have a dual career now. I was wondering why you wanted to conduct when you first started conducting.
Well, I don't think of it as a dual career. I'm a musician, and I have two ways now that I express myself, as a player and as a conductor. But I don't think of them as separate existences.
Was starting to conduct a way of scaling back the performance end, the playing performance end?
No, I think that's like a negative approach. It's something that happened almost by chance. I wasn't actively looking to conduct. But when the occasion arose, I took the opportunity and felt that I had something to say. And it's developed from there.
How did you learn to conduct when you started doing it? What I'm thinking is, when you're very young and you study conducting, then you're in the conservatory and you take classes and everything. When you're older and when you start to conduct, you're not going to go back to the conservatory, and I guess you have to learn more as you do.
I think that applies anyway. You can't dictate a formula and say, if you do that, you will get this result. Max Rudolph's written a wonderful book called The Grammar of Conducting, which goes into every aspect of conducting and conducting certain passages and certain corners and rubatos and things like that. But he says all the way along the line that you can't use this as a strict set of rules as to what you do, because in the end, everyone is different. And I certainly found that of course, at the beginning, I tried different ways of getting results, and found they didn't apply because I was, in fact, imitating somebody else. And until I took the risk to be myself, I think the results weren't as good as I wanted.
You once called conducting the right arm disease.
If you sit in an orchestra, as I did for many wonderful years, you see from time to time somebody hopping up onto the box, determined to be a conductor at all costs. And, of course, nothing incurs the wrath of the players more than that, the upstart, pretentious person who thinks, now I'm on the podium, I have all this power, when in fact you have zero power, because if you can't get the musicians to respond, it doesn't work. And how do you do it? Because you don't make a sound, and the conductor no longer can be tyrannical as they were 30, 40 years ago, where they had the power of almost life and death over the players. If you got the job, you could tell the players to do something, and if they didn't, they got the sack. That doesn't work anymore. You have to justify your position artistically.
You have to earn the respect of the players that you're conducting.
Oh, yes. Remember that those players, generally, have probably been sitting in that orchestra for 25, 30 years. And this certainly applies to the young conductor, they're more experienced musically, quite often, than the conductor.
When you're doing a lot of freelance conducting, is it ever like being a substitute teacher where in the schools I went to, the substitute teacher was always tested when they came into the room. What can we get over this teacher? How much do they really know? And depending on how the teacher performed, the kids would either respect him or her or not. And they'd get a lesson taught or they wouldn't, depending on whether they got the respect. Is it ever that way when you're walking in the first time to a new symphony?
It's like that always with between the players and the conductor. There are sort of basic tricks and
what kind of
sort
tricks?
Disobedience of not obeying an instruction, uh-huh. being told to play louder and you play softer or you whatever. I mean, there are subtle ways of doing it. You don't have to be blatant and downright rude about it. But certainly I've sat in the orchestra and I invented many tricks. You have your own technique.
Oh, tell me one.
Oh, no, they're copyright. I don't want anybody to play them back on me. I think this is fair game because if you sit in an orchestra, you will at some stage be a little bit bored and you'll think, I don't think that conductor knows what he's doing. And you test him. And you may test it in the way you play, how you play in the ensemble. And a good conductor spots that immediately. I mean, that's easy. What you have to, as a conductor, is decide whether the person is doing it unconsciously or consciously. If it's conscious, then it's a trick. And there are ways of dealing with it. It's part of the game. A good conductor. Let me put it this way. When I was in the LSO, I never attempted to play tricks on Stokowski, Ormandy, Pierre Monteur, George Zell. I mean, you wouldn't get away with it. They were too good. They saw the trick coming.
Mm-hmm. But the
and
other,
they throw it back at you.
But a guest conductor, you would?
Not just a guest conductor. It's on a conductor who is perhaps less than competent.
Mm-hmm. You once said that George Zell was the conductor who was cruelest to horn soloists.
He's certainly cruel to me.
What did he do?
Well, my first experience with him was recording the Handel-Harty Water Music Suite. And in that, there's a little section for muted horns, which would last 35, 40 seconds. We spent 40 to 50 minutes on that section. He took it apart. He got playing different note lengths, different dynamics. And I knew, because I'd heard of his reputation, that he was testing me. See how much I could take. And I decided I could take it all. But I think I still have the scars to show.
French horn soloist and conductor Barry Tuckwell is my guest. And I want to talk about your instrument and your musical performances. But first I want to play a little bit of a recent record of yours. And this is a record of Mozart horn concertos. We're going to hear an excerpt of the third movement, the rondo of his Horn Concerto No. 4 with my guest Barry Tuckwell, the French horn soloist. Barry Tuckwell, the French horn soloist, and Barry Tuckwell also conducting the English Chamber Orchestra. You were really the first French horn soloist, the first French horn player to have a career as a soloist. Why wasn't that done more often before?
Well, that's not strictly true, because there was a great horn soloist there were two great horn soloists in the latter part of the 18th century. There was Mr. Leutgeb, for whom Mozart wrote these concertos, mm-hmm. and there was also a man called Giovanni Punto, who was so successful as a horn soloist that he had his own carriage and was an international star in his day and wrote a lot of concertos for himself to play. But they were the last for many, many years. Of course, we have to remember that there was the legendary Dennis Brain, who would have, no question, would have left Philharmonia and become a horn soloist, but he died tragically in a motor car accident. And I think that it's due to his example and his playing, and also his father, Aubrey Brain, that there's such a wonderful public and a public acceptance of the horn as a solo instrument in Britain.
But, you know, if we're talking about violinists or pianists, cellists, we can all think of many soloists who have become very popular around the world. For French hornists, is really very few, and certainly of your generation, you were the first who really went off and succeeded in doing that. Why is it harder for a French hornist? Is it the repertoire?
Oh, there are many reasons. I think it's fashion. Also, one goes back historically. At the beginning of the 19th century, the whole nature of classical music changed. We went from the classical era through Beethoven into the Romantic era, into composers like Liszt and Wagner. And they wrote differently for the orchestra, particularly the brass instruments, which became mechanized. Valves were invented. And so wind instruments, woodwind and brass, became much more important within the orchestra.
When you were with the London Symphony Orchestra, and I think it was 13 years that you were in the symphony, were there times when you were performing in a concert and there was very little work for the French horn to do in the repertory of the evening?
I don't ever remember having an easy concert. To me, just getting a sound out of the horn, to do it responsibly and to do it beautifully is something that's always difficult.
But I ask this knowing that in some pieces, the French horn part is not necessarily a glorious one. And there are even some pieces, let's face it, where the tuba does the and the French horn does the pa-pa, right?
Well, there are certain pieces where you're probably not even aware of the horn. Mm-hmm. Let me think of a good example, I think, is the Beethoven Fourth Symphony, where you really don't hear the horns very much, and they don't play anything. They ba-ba-ba-ba-ba, it's all very pretty. However, there's one note in the middle of the slow movement after something like 12 measures rest, which is a nightmare for all horn players, because out of the blue, it's very quiet. He has to go... It's just those four notes. But, of course, if you don't get it cleanly, if you just play it a little bit later, or, worst of all, you just... Everybody hears and they say, oh, the horn player missed a note. And this is the nature of the instrument. There's probably one note in the whole concert which everybody will remember that you missed.
Yeah, I was thinking too, though, that how exciting it must have been when you became a soloist to have more control over the repertoire and to find the pieces that you really wanted to play that would really show off the aspects of the instrument that you wanted.
Well, this is one of the reasons why I did leave the orchestra. I didn't decide I was sick of orchestral playing, because, in fact, I enjoyed it very much. We had a wonderful time. We played with the greatest conductors. But I felt that I was certainly probably able or capable of saying something a bit more musically than I could say while I was still in harness, playing with the team, which you must do.
Mm-hmm.
And... I did leave for that reason, and indeed I think it was right for me, although I have to say many times I do miss playing in the orchestra.
I think the French horn is a difficult instrument to get started on unless you're assigned it in the school band or something. It's an expensive instrument. Everybody gets a guitar or a piano when they're a kid if their parents are interested in having them play something. I can't think of parents who go out and buy their child a French horn when they're 8 years old. How did you come upon the French horn?
I grew up in a musical family, and my father was a professional pianist and organist. There was always music in the house. There was a piano in the house, which I liked to play, which I studied. I also studied the violin, and I also studied the organ. However, I knew that this was never going to be a way of life for me. I wasn't good enough at those instruments. And when I was 13, somebody handed me a French horn, and I took to it. It was, in fact, I was very lucky, it was something that I could play. And I could read music. And to my mind, at that time, I foolishly thought, this is much easier than the piano or the organ. There's only one note to play at a time. And generally, they're much slower than the notes on other instruments. And, this is wonderful. I've been changing my mind a little bit more every day since then.
What makes the French horn such a challenging instrument to play?
Because there's nothing on it to make a sound. It's just a length of tubing. Same as trumpet or trombone, any of the brass instruments. The player actually has to vibrate the air inside with his lips. And you have many notes to choose from. You can aim for a note and you get another one. It's like playing darts. If you don't aim that dart correctly, you'll get one instead of 20. You won't get 19. You'll be way, way off in number. And in the case of the horn, it's perhaps less efficient than the other brass instruments due to the tapering of the tubing. It's a very long tube, and it starts off with a very, very narrow diameter and ends up with a very, very wide bell. But this produces a very beautiful sound. And if you improve the horn, I say physically improve it, it won't sound like a horn anymore. To have that beautiful sound, you have to play something that doesn't work very well.
When you say it doesn't sound like a horn when you play it well, what does it sound like?
Well, I'm thinking of an instrument which is a much better designed, in a sense, instrument like the trombone. Now, I don't mean the trombone's easy. Mm-hmm. I don't mean that at all. But it's a much more efficient piece of tubing. But if that sounds like a trombone. And if you want a trombone sound, you use that instrument to get the particular quality of sound, which is... I don't know how to describe music. I don't think you can describe music. It's there or it isn't. But the horn has a particular sort of beautiful quality of sound of its own. And to get that, you have to play on an instrument that is basically unreliable.
The French horn being a brass instrument, as you blow into it, it accumulates a certain amount of spit. And with many French horns, what you have to do is kind of roll the instrument back and forth and then turn it over, and the spit comes out. Mm. And I know I played French horn briefly in my high school band, and the really embarrassing part of any performance that we had to do is when you had to clear the spit out of the instrument. How do you handle things like that?
Well, there's very little spit goes into the instrument.
Perhaps, not when I played it.
No, well, I'm just thinking that there's the first loop where obviously there must be some.
Yeah.
But basically what we're talking about is condensation. There's very warm, moist air which collects on the inside of the tube, and it collects several feet round, round many, many corners, and I can't spit that far. And it is a problem because on the horn, I think on my instrument, there are something like 13 or 14 places where this can collect.
Uh-huh.
If that happens to be on what we call a nodal point, because inside all these vibrations, it'll make a note virtually unmanageable. And you go, it's not the player's fault. The instrument just won't do it, so you have to get rid of it. That's why you do see the horn players searching desperately to find out where this is. This perhaps it's one little bead of condensation that's in the wrong place.
So do you, in the parts where you're not playing in a concert, have to go find that?
I have 1, 2, 3 little water keys, we call them, on spots where most of the condensation collects, and I just blow them, hoping that nobody will see what's happening, because I think it's distracting to see a soloist fooling around with his instrument, and you think, what's he? He's in trouble. He's having he's in real trouble, and you see this shaking going on, and it detracts. So I prefer that the instrument should remain still during the bar's rest, where I'm, in fact, blowing the spit, as you call it, out of the horn.
Well, they are called spit valves. I don't know.
They are.
You're talking about how uncontrollable the instrument sometimes is. Have you ever played a concert where you noticeably missed a note?
Oh, I think everybody has. Yes. Yes, I'm human.
Mm-hmm. So how do you... You just go on as if nothing's happened.
Oh, yes. You look.
Well, obviously, it's your only choice.
I when I play, I think of it a bit like driving, that you should be anticipating things going wrong. You should anticipate at every crossroad a car coming across or a child following a ball, all that sort of thing, or it's a corner that it might be icy, so that if something does happen, you're ready for it. And the same way that if you're playing, you know where hazards are. And if you approach it too fast or too loud or something, there's the possibility that it mightn't go quite right. And having anticipated, a minor slip doesn't become a major disaster area. So a good player anticipates and therefore covers potential disasters. Every performance has to be like that. See, if I went for note-perfect, safe performances, they wouldn't be interesting. I take it always to a danger area so that I can say something more. Every performance, if it's a Mozart concerto, I'm often asked if I get bored playing the Mozart concertos. Well, I never get bored, A, because there's always something new to find out in the music. And also, every performance must be a development of the previous performances. And I'll always take something a little bit more, stretch it to the limit, a long phrase or a particular slur. But if I tried to keep it within the safety limits, the performances would be boring. And that is the secret of great performers, that you go away from the performance wondering what it was about it. Of course, if you could analyze it, it could be repeated, and therefore it wouldn't be a great performance. Everybody has some secret, perhaps unconscious secret, way of performing, and if you develop that and think about that, that is what makes an exciting performance.
Yeah, certainly, and you certainly don't walk away thinking, like, every note was accurate. I mean, it is not that that leaves you that wonderful feeling after you've heard a breathtaking concert.
To all instrumentalists, not just the French horn.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I think every instrument comes with its own obsessions. You know, with clarinets, it's the reed. What is it with the French horn that...
Lips. I think we always blame everything on the embouchure.
Mm-hmm.
Incorrectly, quite a lot of the time. It might be just wrong breath support, many things, just basic technique, but we always tend to think it's our lips first. I suppose that's because that's where we're most vulnerable.
Well, also you have to shape every note with your lips. I mean, there's only four vowels right on the French horn.
But you see, if you think of the lips like a string,
mm-hmm.
and the breath like the bow, you need both things. Because in a stringed instrument, it's how you use the bow, which for us is the breath. Same as a singer vibrates the vocal cords. We're vibrating the air inside an instrument. So the two things interact. To say one's more important than the other is like the chicken and the egg.
The teeth really affect the embouchure. Do you have is your dentist your most special doctor?
Oh, indeed. I go to a very special dentist who, in fact, is a horn player. In Jacksonville, Florida, and quite a lot of horn players go to him because he understands our problems and what we have to take care of. And he speaks to me very fiercely sometimes that my gums aren't as good as they should be and I should take more vitamin C and floss more and things like that, because we do have to be careful. It's not basically teeth, it's the gums. If the gums get weak, the teeth move, and then that's curtains.
Mm. You once pointed out that there's showmanship that goes with certain instruments. With the violinist, you see the arms moving as the violinist bows, and with the piano, you also see the arms moving and the head moving away. The French horn, playing a French horn is a very still occupation, yep. I think. There's very little visible showmanship involved with it.
You can't show off as you can on, I'd say, every other instrument. You certainly can on stringed instruments and the piano, and you certainly can on woodwind instruments. You can do it on the clarinet. You can wail around. You can do it on a trumpet and a trombone because they're, more symmetrical with the body. The horn comes round the wrong way and it's too heavy on one side. And if you start doing that, you miss notes. And I have noticed some colleagues who tend to, I think, show off more than is acceptable, just for visual effect. But when it's difficult, they keep very still. I used to say that to colleagues in the orchestra. Well, why don't you move around in that phrase as much as you did in the phrase before? You know, turning the knife, cruel. Because I suppose we feel a bit frustrated at playing the horn. You can't sort of jump around to the same extent.
Before we go, I just have to ask you one more thing. How do you play and conduct in the same piece? I think it would be a lot harder to do that as a French hornist than, for instance, as a clarinetist, because it's a less mobile instrument. You can't stand in front of the orchestra with it and play.
I think it presupposes that musicians need a time beater in front of them.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, when you look at performances, you could be confused, A, because you don't think anybody's watching, mm-hmm. and B, because the conductor doesn't appear to be doing anything that's relevant to what the result is. In the case of what I do, the repertoire that I play, I would only play and conduct classical concertos, Mozart, Haydn, of that period, because they all start off with the orchestra playing alone, and then the soloist comes in, and the musicians listen, and they play with the soloist. And it's generally a strict tempo piece. There are a few little corners where it stops and starts and stops and starts, but that's not a big problem. And you play as a chamber ensemble without there having to be an interpreter between the soloist and the orchestra. This would be totally impractical in contemporary concertos or the big concertos of Richard Strauss. It wouldn't work, mainly because the orchestra is very much larger. And when it gets loud, you can't always hear each other, and then you do need some visual indication of where you should play.
So there is nobody standing up at the front moving
I stand
their
in
arm.
The middle. I stand in the middle, and then I turn around and get things going. And they go, yum, bum, bum, and away I go. Ba-dee-da-da-da-dee-da-da-da, bum-bum-bum-bum-bum-bum. And they're playing in the background, but playing exactly with me, rather than watching somebody who is listening to me.